and I'm Nihal live on the BBC Asian Network. Hope you enjoyed the first hour. We've got some very, very, very inspiring story to come. Gautam Lewis contracted polio as a child, was then abandoned by his parents and ended up in Mother Teresa's mission in India. Ford Whiter today, he's got his own record label and has committed himself to combating India's major polio epidemic. Now he'll be here to answer all my questions, a very, very inspirational person indeed. So if there's anything you'd like to ask him about his life and how he overcame all the difficulties that were put in his way, you can call 08459 440 445. You can text 81869 or email Nihal at bbc.co.uk. But first, let's get the rap with Maimuna Kazi.
Indian spinner Harbhajan Singh has been cleared of racially abusing Australia's Andrew Symonds. He's had his three-match ban lifted, but Harbhajan will still be fined half his match fee for offensive behaviour. Jim Maxwell is a senior cricket commentator with the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. He told me how the Aussie boys will be miffed by this.
I think they've got a lot of things wrong here. The Australians are still outraged, of course, because they feel that Symonds has been racially vilified. And that's why we may get some lingering bitterness in the one-day series.
A 41-year-old woman has been charged in connection with the death of a father in Meacham in South London. The man, who's believed to be in his 40s, was killed in a row over football. Police in West London are questioning three men about the murder of a 19-year-old in a park in Ealing early on Saturday morning. Fun Barali was beaten with a blunt instrument. President Bush has given his last ever State of Union address to Congress. The speech focused on the US economy and military progress in Iraq. Working parents in the UK are paying more than the rest of Europe for childcare, shelling out around £8,000 a year to send just one child to a nursery. England's the most expensive, with Wales and Scotland a grand cheaper. Credit card companies are making millions of pounds in penalty fines because people keep missing their repayments. More than 5 million of us did it in the second half of last year, and it cost around 12 quid each time. And Britney Spears is seeing a psychiatrist. That's what Barbara Walters, an American TV show host, has said. She told viewers she'd been contacted by Britney's manager, who told her the news. Seema Kotecha's got more from the States.
This is the same presenter Paris Hilton wrote to when she was in jail. Now Britney's manager's been talking to her.
He said that Britney is suffering from what he describes as mental issues, which are treatable.
She was also told Britney was in touch with her mum, even though reports suggest the two aren't speaking.
Then Marshall's got your thoughts.
So as we've been hearing, India's tour down under will continue after Budgie was found not guilty of racial abuse. Cumbria's men players sold out 2020 match against the Aussies on Friday. It's Dennis Wise's last day at Leeds before heading north to team up with Kevin Keegan at Newcastle. His actual role hasn't yet been confirmed, but is thought to be a director of football, possibly looking after transfers. Here's former Leeds boss Eddie Gray.
He's had a good time at Leeds United, especially this season. They'd still be top of the table if it wasn't for the 15-point deduction, and that's the only thing you can look at. I mean, there'll be a lot of Leeds United fans who'll be quite pleased to see him go.
Jonathan Woodgate signed for Spurs for around £8 million, and there's a load of games tonight in the Premier League. Newcastle travel to Arsenal again. Joey Barton's on the bench for the Geordies. Bolton hosts Fulham in a big relegation battle. Borough play Wigan, and James McFadden should make his debut for Birmingham against Sunderland. That's the wrap. More in half an hour.
Gonna shake the ground. We gotta get the party down. be put to her.
Punjabi there. Good morning, Lister Nihal on the BBC Asian Network. And the lovely Supriya is here. Hello, darling.
Hello, Nihal. Yes, we've got a few text messages coming in. Indy from Walsall says, I think swearing should be banned because it's really bad. She says, my son used to support Man U, and once he was watching a match and saw Rooney swear. Now he's gone on to support Liverpool, but I think it will be hard to stop abuse on the pitch. Hi. Another one that we've got here, Chetan goes on to say, Nihal, you should read out Mark Ram Prakash's interview in the Telegraph newspaper on how he was racially abused because of his mixed race. Why are they complaining now? When Asians make use of reverse swing ball, it's ball tampering. And when English or Australians do it, it's not. This is wrong. When sledged by Asian players, it's racism. And when Australians do the same, it's mental disintegration.
One rule for one, and one rule for another.
It's just unfair. Another text message here, Jethro says, it seems we're imposing our values onto the Indians, Pakistanis and Sri Lankans. It's strange that these type of incidents would have not happened in the past. So he's basically saying in the UK and Western television this goes on.
Yeah.
So, well, you know, we've just picked on and they're learning from us.
Yeah, no, that's very true. I think Simon Barnes in the Times made that point a couple of months ago. A very good point it was.
That's all we've got. We've got a few more coming in, but we'll come back with that.
Okay, so Priya, thank you very, very much for that. Let's move on with some music. A former record of the week of mine, Kid Skilly featuring Akon with Nissonia.
If I do it like this, can I get it like that? If I do it like this, can I get it like that?
Akon?
Uh-huh.
I see you, Skilly.
I see you, homie.
I'm in your neck of the woods now, baby. So, yeah, yeah. I want you by my side. Looking at you, mesmerized by you, what you want me. Put you up in my ride, just on me, yeah. I need you by my side. Can't help to think that you got no freedom.
To meet ya. I don't really do this, no, it's not procedure. I've been around the globe, seen a bunch of cheap guys. London, Japan, Punjab, America, Venezuela, even Costa Rica. But none compared to your beautiful features. And I don't kick game, no, I sit in the bleachers. You watch these young dudes just try to break ya. All up in your ear like an iPod speaker. Talking that talk like, I got a visa. I got dough. I got a reason you should go. That's when I gotta step in and change your pace. You don't need a rich boy, you need a baby face. Grown and sexy, yet so mature. Bump Joni Legend on the break.
I want you by my side. Looking at you, mesmerized by you, what you want me. Put you up in my ride, just on me. I need you by my side. Can't help you, bitch, you got no freedom for me.
And I met you and I don't dream no more. I can see you on a poster somewhere in the store. Selling Maybelline or maybe Christian Dior. Lil Marshmallow, I'ma call you small. You're sweet like that. I don't mean to be corny, but it be like that. Yeah, you making me horny when you freak like that. Like that, like that. You's a good girl, I can see it in your walk. I like the way you dress, the way you smell, the way you talk. The little things you say that bring me up when I'm down. Need a roadmap when you not around. I get lost, and I ain't scared to say it. Love is a game, I ain't scared to play it. It's when I go home, I'm liking my eyes. But with you by my side, we gon' let it ride.
I want you by my side. Looking at you, mesmerized by you, don't want me. Put you up in my ride, just on me, yeah. I need you by my side.
Now you know we gotta leave this place before the bar closed. What do you suppose? You and I drive off in the road. Door to your crib, which is close to my home. A paint the town green like 6 in the morning. Either way, don't leave my side. I know that you want it, I can see it in your eye. I want it right back. If I do it like this, can I get it like that? So why do you keep talking to me? I need you in my Zendigy. I said that. So why do you keep talking to me? I need you in my Zendigy.
I want you by my side. Looking at you makes me run for you. What you want me? Want you up in my ride. It's on me, yeah. I need you by my side. Can't help you think that you got my freedom for me. Popping up in my life.
What's up? What are you chatting about?
Get on the message board.
bbc.co.uk/AsianNetwork.
From the album Something Special, that is Nachna Ondani, and there you go. You are listening to Nihal on the BBC Asian Network. My next guest may have been taken down by polio, but nothing is stopping him from flying high, quite literally, because Gautam Lewis is not just a successful record label owner, but also a qualified pilot. He's now taking on the challenge of helping to combat India's major polio epidemic, and is here with me now. Good morning, Gautam.
Good morning, Nihal.
How are you? An inspiring fella, no doubt an inspiring man. 30 years old, is that right?
I will be 31 in 2 weeks.
31 in 2 weeks. Well, a very early happy birthday to you,
Thank you very much.
There's so much, obviously, to talk to you about. Okay, now, how old were you when you contracted polio?
It's very difficult to say, because when I was born in Calcutta in 1977, there wasn't really a register of births or deaths.
Right.
It would have been the local midwife.
Right.
The nuns at the Missionaries of Charity for Mother Teresa's organisation, they rescued me when I was around 18 months old.
Right, okay.
And that was when I was abandoned.
Right.
Because I was suddenly paralysed. And in India, if you're a child who's paralysed, it's very difficult. You'll be useful for the family.
Right. Were you born into quite a poor family in Calcutta?
Yeah, I was born in an area called Howrah.
Right.
Which is near the Ganges.
Right.
And there's a very famous bridge called the Howrah Bridge. I suppose it would be something like Canning Town.
Right, in East London.
In East London, yeah.
Right, okay.
So it's kind of dirty, polluted, poor. But West Bengalis are very creative and resilient.
Right, right. Do apologise for anyone who's currently trying to sell their house in Canning Town at the moment. They're obviously just kind of going, oh, God, no, we've just been compared to Calcutta. We're never going to sell our house.
Well, I didn't mean it in that sense.
Yeah, I know you did. I'm just joking. So you were taken into an orphanage at the age of 18 months.
Yeah.
From there, I mean, gosh, I mean, I don't know where to start. I mean, your childhood, how was your childhood?
Arguably, I shouldn't be sitting where I am today with you having this conversation. Because most children, when I was born in Calcutta, were one in five would die from polio.
Right.
And had it not been for the Missionaries of Charities and Mother Teresa, I wouldn't have been given that life. They don't really do anything beyond that, like rehabilitation. So I spent the first 3 years living in an orphanage. The orphanage was called the Mother House in Shishi Bhavan. And at the age of three, I met a English woman called Patricia Lewis, who was working with disadvantaged children in Calcutta after finishing her degree. And they would go around all the orphanages looking for disabled children, and they would then take them to a rehabilitation centre. So then from the ages of... So I got moved from Mother Teresa to this orphanage at around 4 years old. And then for the next 3 years, I spent having operations to try and get me... Because it was only when I was about 8 years old did I start walking.
Right. Wow.
Yeah. So up to that point, I was kind of being carried or crawling around, and so all my operations were in Calcutta.
Right.
And they were doing corrective surgery, so every 6 months I'd have a different operation, and then I'd be on traction for 6 months to try and stretch all the legs out. So it was quite a traumatic time.
Yeah.
If anything.
Yeah.
So for the first 7 years of my life, it wasn't spent at play school, it wasn't spent in a playground, it wasn't spent learning A, B, C, D or 1, 2, 3, 4. It was sort of being left in various orphanages.
And in and out of hospital.
In and out of hospital and just surviving.
Wow. And with the help of Mrs. Lewis, you managed to... Okay, so once you got to 8 years old, what happened then?
Well, I left Calcutta when I was just after 7 years old.
Right.
When I first met Patricia, I was three.
Right.
And over the next 4 years, she would come backwards and forwards to Calcutta. And bit by bit, the two of us created a bond. And when I was 7 years old, she came back to Calcutta to adopt me.
Right.
Which was the very last thing she thought about ever doing. She was 27 when she did that.
Was she married at that stage? Right, okay.
She just started her career. She was working as a lecturer of nuclear physics at the University of Auckland.
Wow.
And then people sensed that, you know, she kept talking about this special boy in India. And they said, why don't you go and adopt him? And that was the first time she thought about it.
Which is presumably a lot easier to do in 1984, was it, than it is to do now?
It's nowadays,
yeah.
If you want to adopt someone from India, if it's one person, they have to be from India, or if it's a couple, one of you has to be from India.
Oh, really?
So now it's actually, my adopted mother could not have done that.
That's what I mean, yeah, yeah. Back then in mid-80s.
Mid-80s. I was actually made her ward.
Right.
Which meant that she could take me out of the country. Because had the adoption process gone through the Indian courts, it may have been more costly. It may have been...
Still be there.
I could still be there. I've learned a little bit about Indian bureaucracy, and you either love it or you hate it.
Right. Either way, you've just got put up with it,
exactly.
Haven't you? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I left Calcutta and, you know, screamed all the way to the airport because I had no idea what was going on, where I was going.
But as a child who's building a bond up with Patricia Lewis, it must have been heartbreaking every time she left, wasn't it?
It was. You know, I completely agree with you. And then that is another feeling of being left.
Yeah.
And being abandoned by someone that you feel cares about you.
How long did she used to stay for?
Sometimes it was a year, sometimes it was a few weeks,
stay for a year with you and then have to say goodbye.
Well, she would be working as a volunteer.
Oh. So you'd see her every day?
Yeah. I mean, she loves cats.
Right.
She now has two Labradors.
Right. Who probably don't love cats particularly.
No, but she adopted these Labradors. Anyway.
Right, okay, right.
And because I knew she loved cats and I was in traction, which meant you were in a bed on your own for months at a time, whenever there would be a little cat nearby, I would grab it and just sort of, in a sort of mischievous way, you know, sort of make the cat uncomfortable, knowing that she would come and tell me to stop teasing the cats. And then
wow.
I could sit with her and chat for a half an hour or an hour.
Wow.
So I've always been quite good at getting people's attention.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so she brought you to UK when you were 7 years old?
Well, no, then we left India and I went to New Zealand.
To New Zealand.
So,
oh, she was Auckland,
you know, you go from a plane journey and you leave, inverted commas, the black hole of Calcutta.
Mm.
And we arrived in Auckland on a beach on a sunny day. It was paradise, you know.
Yeah.
On a plane journey, you do that, eating chocolate ice cream. You know, you suddenly, you know, you take a, you know, because I have so many turbulent memories from Calcutta, the minute I arrived in Auckland, suddenly all of my memories are crystal clear. Because the change of that impact was so massive. Mm. And up to that point, massive changes were happening in my life. And I suppose from that moment on, you know, there you have a second chance in life. And I was arguably one in a million kids from the streets of Calcutta that had that chance. And probably when I was 7 years old, I knew that.
Yeah, I can imagine. Now.
So then the adoption went through the New Zealand courts.
Yeah.
So I actually have a New Zealand birth certificate.
Right, okay.
But it says I was born in Calcutta.
Right, okay.
And...
Do you have an NRI status as well?
And I now have a British citizenship.
Right.
A British passport.
Oh, right, okay.
So it's very difficult to tell people where I come from.
Wow, okay. Well, a child of the world, which is a good way to be.
Yeah, so in New Zealand, I learned basic English, maths, you know, reading and writing.
Right.
And I really started my schooling when I came to London. So I arrived in London 1988.
Right.
And I went to a little school, not a little school, it was a school called Hill House in Knightsbridge.
Which is where Harry and William went, isn't it?
And Prince Charles.
And Prince Charles, yeah.
So complete contrast. to wow. the orphanage of Calcutta.
How did you end up in there? Is this with the help of...
It was with the help of my mother, my adopted grandparents. Because really, you know, I was so late in starting education. Right. They wanted
you had a
to
lot
give me the best chance. Right. But also my grandparents lived very close to the school.
Right.
And because my mother travelled a lot, when she did travel with her work, I would stay with my grandparents.
Right.
So, you know, I got very close to them. And then when I left Hill House, I went to a boarding school called Beedales in Hampshire.
Right.
Which is, again, a completely different world to the opportunities that
kids... This is the heart of the British establishment in many ways, isn't it? Public school system... I mean, Beedales, I've heard of Beedales. I mean, I've definitely heard of Hill House, but Beedales I've heard of as well. So suddenly, this child with polio from Calcutta is in the heart of the British kind of, you know, the pampered British upper classes.
Well, Hill House is...
It's a bit more mixed, isn't it, Hill House?
Well, Beedales is not like Eton.
Right.
Beedales is very liberal.
Right.
It doesn't conform the individual to an academic structure. It does the opposite.
Huh.
It looks at the individual and brings out their best talents. So
yeah.
for me, who wasn't very academic but still needed an education, you know, I learned about photography and art and design and how to bake bread and, you know, weird stuff like that.
Right, well, you went through this this whole thing. Now, fast forward to last year, the year before, I'm not sure when you started doing this, but... Going back to India, after discovering that India has registered the highest number of polio cases of any single country, this year, I presume that's 2007 that they did, at what point did you decide, right, I'm going to go back to India?
It's towards the... I left the music industry in 2005.
Right.
As you know, the music industry touches the hearts and the lives of many people through music.
Absolutely.
I worked as management as well as a record label manager with Alan McGee. And
the man who found Oasis.
Oasis.
Yeah.
And, you know, with help from him and other people, you know, I got to experience the bona fide kind of rock and roll lifestyle.
Yeah.
You know, 99% hard work, 1% fun, always last man standing as manager. I've always been a kind of a man of the people.
Right.
You know, I've always acknowledged where I've come from.
Right.
And I've always been very proud that, you know, because of Mother Teresa and other people, people who give up everything to help others, that I wasn't getting that level of fulfillment from the music industry. Because when you reach a certain level, for me, it just suddenly became far too greedy, far too sordid, and far too about keeping people alive to sell records.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't want to spend the next 20 years selling egotistic rock stars or trying to promote them. As much as I love music,
yeah.
I suddenly got caught up in the reality of the business side of music.
Yeah, which is very little to do with loving music, isn't it?
Yeah, it's to do with selling t-shirts and buying houses and getting your songs on BMW advert, whatever it is.
You know,
there is the corporate side.
Yeah.
You know, I've worked with some of the biggest labels in the world, as well as coming from a very independent Alan McGee Maverick school of rock and roll.
Yeah, absolutely.
I also had a guy called Stephen King, who was very much the business head of everything. Collectively, after 6 or 7 years, I just started to feel really strained, spiritually, emotionally, mentally, by the whole activity.
Right.
So I left and started learning to fly aeroplanes.
Right, okay, that's a good point, I think, to stop for a second, and we'll come back to talk about, how you ended up back in India, why you decided to go back into India, and why you decided to start flying planes, and we'll get into all of that after we get the wrap with Sonal Patel.
Indian cricket official. officials have cleared player Harbhajan Singh of racial abuse. He'd been banned for 3 matches for allegedly insulting Australia's Andrew Symonds in the second test. The Tory MP, who paid his uni student son to be his researcher, is set to be investigated again. It's alleged Derek Conway paid another son while he was a student. And working parents in the UK are paying more than the rest of Europe for childcare, shelling out around £8,000 a year just to send one child to a nursery. England's the most expensive, with Wales and Scotland about £1,000 cheaper. Sport now with Paul.
Thanks, Donald. Budgie's successful appeal means the tour is on. The 2020 match with the Aussies will go ahead on Friday. Then it's the Commonwealth Bank Series with the hosts and Sri Lanka. Dennis Wise starts work at Newcastle today. It's an executive position on the board. Tonight, the Magpies take on Arsenal again at the Emirates. Joey Barton had his bail conditions changed so he can play. Elsewhere, Bolton take on Fulham. Sunderland face Birmingham and Wigan travel to Middlesbrough. The North East club have sold defender Jonathan Woodgate to Spurs for £8 million. That's it for now. We'll have more in half an hour.
Asian Network. Taking the sound of British Asian music around the world. The biggest acts.
Adnan Sami, MIA, Jay Sean, Jassy Zoo.
The finest DJs.
Second and
Tunes
Group, the Johnny MD.
The best producers.
Junker, Etan, Lord, Zeus, Rashid Rich, B21.
The sickest MCs.
Riz MC.
Live sessions, interviews, and showcasing unsigned, homegrown talent. It ain't just a music moment. This is what we do. Asian Network. The home of British Asian music. Find out more. Click bbc.co.uk/Asian Network.
I wasn't aware that Adnan Sami was British Asian music, but there you go, you learn something new every single day, don't you? You are listening to Nihal on the BBC Asian Network. Good morning to you. I'm here with Gautam Lewis, and a totally inspiring man who left Calcutta at a very young age after contracting polio and ending up in Mother Teresa's home, and then ended up at the same school that Prince William, Prince Harry and Prince Charles went to. Quite a story. We're going to find out more about Gautam's flying lessons and also why he has decided to go back to India and help India with its polio epidemic after we listen to this track, which is my single of the week. It's Addictive, featuring T2 remixed by the man Rishi Rich, and the track is called Gonna Be Mine. Rishi Rich remixing Gonna Be Mine by Addictive featuring T2, and that is my single of the week, and I absolutely love that remix that Rishi has done of that. I'm here with Gotham Lewis, a very, very inspiring man indeed, 31 in 2 weeks' time. Now, we need to get on to what you're doing in India. You did mention beforehand, of course, flying lessons, deciding to. Now, why did you decide you wanted a pilot's license?
I've always, always loved flying aeroplanes ever since I got in one that took me out of Calcutta.
What?
I don't know. I just fell in love with the freedom of flying.
Right.
The fact they can take you anywhere in the world. And after,
your disability was no bar to all.
People who have disabilities always have a bar to everything.
Right.
It's just how you overcome those.
Okay.
So yes, there was an issue. I mean, obviously on radio no one can see what I look like, but I walk with crutches,
yeah.
And I wear a calip on my left leg.
Right.
Some people use wheelchairs, but that doesn't stop you flying.
Right.
So just as a sort of therapy to get over, you know, Pete Doherty and other people in the world of rock and roll, I just went off and followed my dream.
Just to make it clear, you were managing Pete Doherty, weren't you? So you were part of his management team.
Yeah, it was. There was three of us that took the reins to manage the Liberties.
Yeah.
And I had a very one-to-one with the Special One.
Yes, quite. Okay. So anyway, okay. Back to
so. You know, I had the time, and I just did some research, and.
Yeah.
There aren't many places where people with disabilities are accommodated in aviation. Soon as someone says you can't do something, that will trigger me to go and find out how to do it.
Right.
So I spoke to the civil aviator. I did everything that you have to do.
Right.
And I found the right school. My first 10 hours my tuition was by an RAF Tornado fighter pilot who gave me his time for free. I then moved to Norwich and learned from another guy, and then I ended up finishing at Cranfield near Bedfordshire. And 18th of September last year, I did my 4.5 hour flight test, and then as we landed without the engine, because he did a little trick on me, well, we glided the aeroplane in, he just said, "All right, cool, here you've passed, he's from Skegness." And that was it, and then I've got my wings. Since then, I've been running a website called Freedom in the Air,
right.
Which is about giving people with disability who have a talent and an ambition to fly to find a source of information.
Wow.
Through my flying, I generated quite a lot of print media and other TV press because it was something new in general aviation.
Yeah.
You know, that a person with disability is doing this. I mean, my ambition is to go all the way to becoming a flying instructor and complete that circle. But, you know, I'm taking my baby steps.
Right, okay. And let's get into India.
Yes.
And reasons why you've decided to go back there. Because, I mean, what is your connection with India? Because it's a place of pain, really, in terms of memories. It's a place that didn't treat you particularly well. You had to be taken out of India to be given the kind of life that you have now. So what is your relationship like with India?
Until very recently, I had gone out of my way to block India out of me.
Right.
I didn't want to know that I was from India. But as I've got older, my own self-identity has been kind of reconnected. So I know who I am, where I'm from, and I'm proud of everything. And
that's a fairly recent.
That's a very. I mean, for example, I don't speak Bengali. I don't speak Hindi because I've gone out of my way to forget it.
Right, right.
I tried to lose all connection with India, but
because
I suppose
you would have spoken it fluently by 8 years old.
Yeah,
you?
And I think most people speak their one or two dialects around Hindi and whatever their local dialect is.
Mm.
But you know. I'm very much part of India, and India is very much part of me, like it or hate it.
Right, right.
And when I was learning to fly aeroplanes, I was learning different things about myself. My disability does not define who I am, but at the same time, I was trying to understand how I've become who I am through the disability. So I started to learn about what I can do and harness my experience, my skills and my abilities and channel that towards good and meaningful causes.
Right.
Because I believe that, you know, for someone who's had that strange change of life, there's a purpose to where my life should go. And learning about polio, which is something I didn't even know about it, I only got vaccinated only a few months ago, for example, because I thought I had polio. That doesn't mean you can't get it again. So as I was learning about polio eradication, Rotary International, which is a philanthropic service organization made out of volunteers, they have 1.2 million members, 90,000 members in India, and it's all made up of professionals and business leaders. 20 years ago, they committed to polio eradication as a global health campaign.
Right.
Because they were looking for ways to improve childhood immunization around the world. And
this is entirely preventable, isn't it?
It absolutely. Like smallpox got is preventable. I mean, that polio is 5,000 years old.
Right.
Rotary eventually started reading about my adventures in aviation. And somehow we both connected to each other. And last November they asked me if I would like to go to India as a polio eradication advocate to promote the campaign and to raise awareness for it in India. You're right in saying that India is currently, it has the most amount of cases. The other three countries is Afghanistan, Pakistan and Nigeria. To put things into context, when the campaign started 20 years ago, population in the world was only 4 billion. It's now 6 billion. And that 2 billion increase has been in Asia.
Yeah.
India has a population of 1.2 billion.
Mm.
Nigeria has 125 million.
Mm.
Now, it was really in 1988 that once polio eradication was eradicated in the developed world, they then moved on to the developing world. So if you said to someone 10 years ago, we're going to eradicate polio from India,
yeah,
they'll laugh at you. Now, 20 years ago, there were over 350,000 cases a year.
In India?
In the world.
Oh, in the world, okay.
Last year, India only had total 756 cases.
Right, okay.
Right? So we are now at the very much the end of the campaign. Now, Rotary International works with...
Well, why is it true that India has registered the highest number of polio cases of any single country last year if we're at the end of it?
Well, we're at the end. We're not at the end of it yet. To be polio free,
yeah,
from the last case of polio, you need to have 3 years without a single case.
Right, okay.
Right? So at the moment, the numbers are going down. In Nigeria, there may have been close to 400 or 500 cases in the world. In Nigeria, total for last year. So if you add up the four endemic countries, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Nigeria, and India, it was just short of 1,100 cases.
Right, which is
as opposed to 350,000 cases.
Yeah, it's a very manageable amount of people.
From 100%, we've gone to 1% that now needs to be dealt with. There are three strains of polio.
Right.
1 to 3. Strain 2 has been completely wiped out.
Right.
Strain 3 causes paralysis, but not as severe as strain 1.
Right.
So, type 1 polio is the most dangerous. And
is that what you had?
Probably, but no one knows because I never really got assessed properly.
Right.
But type 1 is the most dangerous. It causes the severest amount of polio and leads to death. Last year in India, there were maybe, out of that 756 cases, just short of 300 cases of type 1.
Right, okay.
So, yeah, it's going in the right direction. And
what are you doing? I mean, personally now, what's your mission? What are you doing?
I am working with all the partnerships, which is Rotary, World Health Organization, UNICEF, and the Center for Disease Control in the States. As someone who's lived with polio, overcome all the barriers that are put in front of you as a person with disability, going to India last year was a really good way for me to connect with the poorest person who are the people that needs to be targeted. I was someone that was very credible for them to understand that, you know, immunization is good for them. A lot of people have concerns and fears that this is not a good thing. There are lots of reasons. You know, in India, Uttar Pradesh is predominantly a Muslim state, and it's also a very poor state. Sanitation is bad. Infrastructure is terrible. You know, yes, India is a developing country, and it has a strong leadership in global economy, but, you know, it's no different to what England was 150 years ago. So what I can do is I can connect with local people and explain to them where I've come from and why it's important for me to explain to them that I don't want what happened to me to happen to their children. And I think they kind of believe me. You know.
Have attitudes in India changed towards disability, do you think? I mean, the same reason why, you know, your parents decided, well, we can't cope with you. Is that still widely accepted, that that's just the way it is in India, or has that attitude changed, do you think, in the last two decades?
I went to schools in Delhi, which was mixed ability school. They had disabled children and they had non-disabled children in the same classrooms, working together.
Right.
So yes, there are pockets where that happens, but it's really difficult when you live in the rural parts. You know, 70% of India still lives in the rural areas.
Mm.
You know, you are very poor. You might have to have five or six children to then run the farm and look after you. And if you don't have enough money to barely feed yourselves, how can you then look after someone with a disability?
Yeah.
There is no National Health Service. There is no disability living allowance. There isn't anything whereby people are supported unless it's by the NGOs and the non-government organizations, but they can't reach everyone. Sure, people are very resilient in India, and that's the one thing that I'm really amazed about. I mean, yes, we sort of discussed recently all the various problems in India, but you know, India has great thinkers, it has great writers, it has great musicians, it has great scientists. You know, it's a democracy, there's freedom of religion. Amongst all of that, you know, people are very caring for their own self and their own family, and the family structure in India is really tight. But disability will always be a difficult issue to overcome because, you know, I mean, when I've been to Delhi or Calcutta, I found it very extremely uncomfortable looking at people begging on the street, knowing that they're probably polio people, you know, they've had polio, and there's no one there to help them.
No, there isn't any safety net at all.
No, and they have to, you know, beg, they have to just survive. And why I find that is uncomfortable is because it's a mirror image and the ghost of the life that I could have had.
Right.
You know, so yeah, I think I gave a lot of people when I went to India a boost to say, well, look, there is a person who has a disability. His life is not ruined.
Mm.
And in fact, yeah, there was a lot of luck that came up my way, and there's a lot of chance that I encountered. But then I've always known that I must not ever waste the opportunities that I've had in life.
Absolutely. And in this mission that you're on right now, have you roped in any of the people that you've met over the years? Because you've met some very famous people, so you went to school with the children of very famous people. Have you managed to get them excited about your cause?
I'm working on them.
Right, okay.
My next sort of development in this overall campaign is to do some fundraising activities.
Right.
Which I will then hope to harness the voice of the high profile people that I've come across.
How much does it cost for a polio vaccination to help a child, for a child to be vaccinated? Do we know? Do you know?
A few dollars.
A few dollars, really? Is that all?
I mean, in the last.
So a pound?
Yeah.
It could cost that too.
25 rupees per drop.
Right.
You know, what's that? I don't know.
25 rupees is about, it's about 80, 90 rupees a pound, isn't it? So it's, yeah, about 25p or something.
I mean, in the last 20 years, $5 billion has been spent on a global campaign.
Right. And it's worked.
Yeah, well, 200...
$5 billion. That's a lot of money.
210 countries are now polio-free.
Right.
So we know it works.
Right.
There are only four countries left. India, because of the sheer population and the sheer size of the country, will be challenging.
Yeah.
But it will be the key to it all.
Right. That's the battle you have to win, basically.
10 billion drops have been given and 2 billion children have been reached. And arguably, if you... there is an argument to say it should be control eradication, so polio, as opposed to work towards eradicating it. If you go for control, it will ultimately cost more than eradication.
And nature will always have a way of infecting the population again, right? It'll always find a way.
Yeah, and so if you don't finish the job, in the next, the World Health Organization forecasts that in the next 10 years, the next 40 years, another 10 million children will be paralysed.
Wow. Gordon, we're going to have to leave it there, but is there any websites that people can visit to find out more about what you're doing?
They can visit thepowerofdreams.co.uk.
Thepowerofdreams.co.uk. Gordon Lewis, thank you very, very much for joining us this morning.
Well, thank you on behalf of all those children.
Perfect. Now, let's move on with Lady Roo, and the track is called Chances Are. Remember, thepowerofdreams.co.uk.
Just took a chance of love. bbc.co.uk/AsianNetwork.
Digital television, digital radio across the UK.
BBC Asian Network.